Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to this episode of the College Commons Podcast and our conversation with Rabbi Joshua Weinberg. Rabbi Weinberg is Vice President of the Union for Reform Judaism for Israel and Reform Zionism, and Executive Director of the Association of Reform Zionists of America, widely known by its acronym, ARTZA. Rabbi Weinberg was ordained from the Israeli Rabbinic Program of the Hebrew Union College and is currently living in New York. He previously served as the Director of the Israel Program for the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College and as faculty of Heller High in Israel. He made Aliyah to Israel in 2003, is a reserve officer in the IDF Spokespersons Unit, and has hiked the Israel Trail. Welcome, Rabbi Joshua Weinberg, Josh, to the College Commons Podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, and it's really nice to be with you.
You are a leading voice of Zionism within the Reform Movement of North America and Israel. So let's break down the idea of liberal or Reform Zionism in the first place. Start off by telling us, what is the most useful definition that you have at your disposal for the word Zionism?
Thank you for asking. And I'm glad that we're getting right into the heart of the matter, as you know that the word Zionism can be used in many different ways and people have their own definitions. I see Zionism very simply as, of course, it was the aspiration for a Jewish people to have their ancestral homeland and build a sovereign state there. And of course, that was achieved in 1948. So in my mind, Zionism is the application of Israel's foundational document, the Declaration of Independence, where we talk about our collective past and we aspire for the values that it sets out of liberty, peace, and justice. And it is really trying to create the society that we as Jews can create, and that is creating a just society in the state of Israel.
All right. So let's move on then to the second part of your remit, effectively. What does the qualifier reform mean when applied to the idea of Zionism?
I would say that it's really about three things. It's really about our Jewishness and our collective responsibility and our commitment to Jewish peoplehood, that we as Jews are really responsible for one another. And it's our commitment to the physicality and safety and security of Jews. But that's only number one. In terms of number two, I would actually say that it's about Judaism. And this is really the heart, because we know that the founders of Zionism were coming to create this national existence and reinvent themselves in our land, both as a way to escape, you know, adversity, persecution, and anti-Semitism, but also as a way to reinvent Judaism. And I think we as a reform movement are reimagining what it means to be Jewish in a Jewish state. We're creating new kinds of expressions and building an authentic form or creation of Israeli Judaism that I think affects also Jews around the world. And then the third piece, when it comes to the liberal piece or even the reform piece, is that, you know, we look at ourselves as trying to balance between that particularism and the universalism. So Zionism was also about us having power, being able to defend ourselves and being able to not have to fear the things that we used to fear when we didn't have power. But that also comes with great responsibility, and that we should be accountable to those who are powerless now in our society when it is we who have power. It works actually nicely with Hillel's saying, in that first, you know, we have to be for ourselves. And then we have to ask the question, you know, who are we? What does it mean to be Jewish? And then, of course, if I'm only for myself, what am I? And that we have to take care of those who are powerless, who are living under our sovereignty.
After October 7th, many Jews around the world and in Israel have redefined their relationship to Judaism, to themselves, to their families, and of course to Israel. I like your tripartite definition. Has October 7th and all of the cascading events and consequences that flow from it highlighted one of those three components over the other two?
I think that it kind of perfectly emphasized all three. I think, you know, the people are coming out of the woodwork now, and we actually sort of coined that phrase of the October 8th Jew who woke up and said, oh my goodness, like this is a major game-changing historical event of just devastating proportions that we need to be together as a people. And that leaves some big questions like, okay, well, what does it mean to be Jewish? And what are our obligations? And how do we balance the notion of the importance and necessity to defend ourselves after, you know, this horrific, unthinkable attack on our people? And many people have looked up and said, okay, yes, of course we have the right to defend ourselves. Is what Israel's doing purely self-defense, or has it crossed some line? Right. Some say no, some say yes. I have my own opinions on it, but I think it raised all of those questions equally. Right. And there are different, you know, members of our movement and people who are broadly associated with the reform movement who some say, okay, no, Israel's completely justified. And this is about us. And this is about our sense of collective responsibility and our deep need to preserve our own physicality and to protect ourselves. And there are others who are saying, look at what we're doing. And that needs to be deeply, deeply examined. So there's no question that October 7th was a game changer. And we as a Jewish people will never be the same after that moment and the ensuing war, of course. And I think that for many different people, it raised, I would say, equally those three questions.
In 2018, a volume was published called The Fragile Dialogue, New Voices of Liberal Zionism. And you wrote a chapter in that volume titled, Is There Common Ground? In your chapter, you set up two contrasts. One is the contrast between American Zionism and other diaspora forms of Zionism. And the contrast you set up there has to do with the fact that American Zionism has not been so connected to the idea of immigration to Israel, but rather connected to the idea of support for Israel from afar. But in the same chapter, you also set up a second contrast, which is the contrast between Jews within the United States, which is to say American Reform Judaism in relation to Israel, as contrasted with American Orthodox Judaism in relation to Israel. And so I can understand why the success of American Judaism might make our experience less about immigration to Israel. But what I don't necessarily understand is why does the Reform contrast with Orthodoxy have a similar effect?
Taking a zoom out approach, I see being Jewish involving three sacred relationships: God, Torah, and Israel. Now, I didn't make this up. I can't take credit for that.
By Israel, you mean the people Israel, not necessarily the state of Israel.
Right. But I think that's open to interpretation. You know, when we say, in the original Aramaic, Yisrael, or right to the Kutcha Brichu, right, they probably meant the people of Israel, just like when we say, you know, Ahavat Yisrael, the love of Israel, really refers to the people. But I think that some relationship with God, some relationship with Torah, and some relationship to Israel is tantamount, sort of the foundation of what it means to be Jewish, regardless of where you live. And my hope is that we as Reformed Jews can embrace all three, whether we agree or not, or whether we see it very differently. You know, we may have different answers for those questions, and that's good. What I see in other movements, particularly some in the Orthodox movement, is a built-in culture of where Israel, specifically the state of Israel, including travel and visiting, is much more inherent and much more sort of obvious to many. And my hope is one day that that can be for us as well. For instance, the latest statistic, which is already now a few years old, shows that only 43% of Reformed Jews have ever visited Israel. And that number doubled since 1999 or the year 2000 with the advent of the Birthright program. And so I think that that's something to work on. My hope is that just like I would want every Jew to be somehow connected to a Jewish community and to embrace some sort of Torah study and practice and observance, I also want every Jew to have been to Israel and to say, oh yeah, that's part of who we are, that we have taken active participation and relationship with the Jewish state. I mean, we have it out there. And that's a massive cultural change. You know, I would love it that if every Reform high school student saw it as part of their, how do you say, their maslul, their course through Jewish life, that we go to camp, we go to a youth urban synagogue, and that we spend a semester or a summer or a year in Israel. It's more commonplace in the Orthodox world to spend a gap year in between high school and university, either studying at a yeshiva or doing something similar. And I would love to ingrain that into our culture of the Reform movement. And of course, to support, you know, a number of our Reform programs, because first of all, I want people to know the Hebrew language. The Hebrew language for me is the carrier and the conveyor of Jewish peoplehood and Jewish history and culture, frankly, that comes through language. And it's hard to do that without a serious immersive experience. And frankly, Israel is the largest Jewish community in the world. And I deeply believe what the prophet Isaiah said, that we often say in our prayers, that Ki Mitzion Tetzé Torah, that from Torah comes out of Israel. Connecting back to the idea that Louis Brandeis, you know, offered about 110 years ago, his Zionism made him a good American. Chaim Weizmann wrote him a letter afterwards and said, okay, if you're such a Zionist, why don't you come over? And he said, well, I'm not, you know, not exactly going to do that right now. And I want to challenge that. I want us to be able to be deeply rooted in our home, which can be, you know, Los Angeles, Miami, wherever. And I also want us to be deeply rooted in our homeland as well.
You asked us to zoom out, which was fair play, but I really want to zoom in. You write of the conditionality of liberal Jewish commitments to Israel, and you cite the vigorous criticisms of Israel from within the American Jewish left, as well as a certain distancing from Israel also within the American Jewish left or center left or what have you. I have long felt that we misdiagnose those feelings coming from the liberal and far left of American Judaism. I interpret the critique in its vigor as a kind of commitment, often mislabeled as anti-Zionist or even anti-Israel. I also interpret the distancing as an illustration of discomfort with Israeli policy on the one hand and the tension with their love of Israel as a country on the other. In other words, in both cases of the distancing in the center left and the critique from the farther left, I'm not sure that liberal American Jews feel as distant from Israel as we tend to interpret them sociologically. Bottom line, the conflicted feelings themselves betray an underlying commitment. Do you buy that argument?
I'm not sure. First of all, you know, the answer, and this is the answer to any good Jewish question, is that it really depends. And I'm not saying that as a cop-out here, but yes, first of all, criticism of Israel should be paramount. It should be, you know, everyone should have that sort of criticism of Israel. And I want to say that, you know, to use my previous, you know, sort of foundational statement, just like we as American Jews should be critical of Torah, that doesn't mean that we reject Torah, right? It means we engage in it more and we turn it upside down and inside out and look for answers. That's what I hope our critique looks like. Now, here are a few examples when I see that distancing. And frankly, it does come from a point of privilege because look, who are the most critical people of Israel? Israelis. Just open up an Israeli newspaper and you'll see criticism left and right. But they have not abandoned the project. So I hear, and this is not new, this has been going on for, you know, 20 years at least, where people say, oh, because of an action of a specific politician or government or the army or the military, whatever, I can no longer associate myself with Israel. That for me does symbolize a certain kind of distancing and critique that only people who have the luxury to be able to say such a thing can say it. For a second example, let's examine what that criticism looks like. So someone says, okay, I'm against the occupation. And therefore, because of the ongoing occupation, you know, we're talking about the 1967 occupation that doesn't seem to be ending any day soon. I think that the Zionist enterprise is a failed endeavor and must be dismantled. That to me goes beyond the pale. And that leads me to my last point is to say, let's ask the sort of Talmudic question of Lema HaDavar Domeh, you know, to what can this be compared? And I would say to the United States, actually. And the current administration right now actually gives us a prime opportunity example, because there may be many Americans who did not vote for the current president, who may be upset at the policies that he's carrying out. But what conclusion do they come to? They could say, all right, we have to protest in the streets. are we have to, you know, do everything we can to overturn the elections through the democratic process and our civic engagement next time. And I would say, wonderful, berakasha, you know, please. And what they're not saying is, okay, we're going to leave the United States. I mean, some may, but very few, actually. And we're not saying that this republic that was, you know, founded 250 years ago or whatever, that it was a failed mistake and must be now dismantled and every state should be, you know, an independent country. That's not what they're saying. Yet we hear those critiques of Israel, and that's where I think it becomes problematic. And I hope that we can teach a different strategy or a different approach towards it.
Let's talk about ways we can take a different approach. And in particular, one of the most compelling examples of how American Jews can and do support Israel, even without immigration. One of these avenues for support of Israel is the World Zionist Congress, which is, to most people, and indeed to most Jews, a complete mystery. What is the World Zionist Congress? Why is it important? And how do American Jews relate to it?
This is really one of the most important ways that we can have our say and we can raise our voices. And so thank you for asking. And that we joke and say that this is the most important election you've never heard of. But for all your listeners, from March 10th to May 4th, 2025, the voting is going to be open to vote for our movement, for the reform movement, to represent us at this World Zionist Congress. Now, this was Theodore Herzl's invention, you know, in 1897, right, almost 130 years ago, where he sought to bring all the Jews of the world together in this parliament, you know, like a Congress, and decide the big questions facing the Jewish people at the time, namely, how do we get a state of our own? Now, fast forward, you know, 51 years, and that vision was in fact achieved, and that, you know, a state was born. And these institutions were kept on. This is the World Zionist Organization, Kakal, or the Jewish National Fund, the Israeli version of the Jewish National Fund, and the Jewish Agency for Israel, which were these pre-state institutions that now exist alongside the government of Israel and the other Jewish and Zionist organizations around the world. And it's really the only table that one can sit at where there is diversity across the ideological, religious, political spectrum, as well as geographical diversity, where people are really coming from wherever there's a Jewish community in the world. So it's a critically important opportunity for us as Reform Jews to have our voices heard. That's in fact why ARTSA was created in 1977, was to represent the Reform movement there. And all one has to do is vote. One has to be 18 years or older. One has to be self-identified as Jewish. And one has to live in the United States. You have to pay a small administrative fee of $5 and fill out the forms online and make sure that you vote reform, number three on the ballot, okay? And here's what's at stake. Unbelievable budgets of the collective Jewish philanthropic enterprise and our ability to control those for our own agenda, tolerance, pluralism, equality, justice, all of those things, as well as if we care where land is bought and sold, in the both land of Israel and the state of Israel, well, we better have a seat around that table to make sure that we can control that. So we have a slate of delegates, and I believe you are on with us. You know, we're honored to have you. And you can go to voteforreform, that's the number 4.org, to see our slate, to read our platform, and to learn all about it. And we'll ask everyone to make sure that they vote and get everyone else that they know to vote starting March 10th.
All right. So I'd like to go back to some theory and rhetoric and politics. In political conversations, Zionists often refer to Israel's bona fides as the lone democracy in the Middle East, or to its achievements as the now proverbial startup nation. What do you say to the argument that those justifications for Zionism actually misdirect our attention from the much more foundational claim of Jewish indigeneity in the land of Israel?
Well, I don't see that they're a contradiction in terms. I mean, I think that, you know, we Jews have a right to the land. And by the way, so do the Palestinians have their own indigenous claims as well. And the fact that we're the only democracy in the Middle East does not exempt us from constantly examining and working to preserve that democracy. It doesn't mean that it's not being threatened both from within and from without. This is deeply part of why I'm a Reformed Jew, is that democracy as a form of government is in fact a Jewish expression, because democracy is not just about majority rule. It's also about recognizing the rights of the minorities and making sure that the state puts in a place to protect those who are powerless. Otherwise, like we say in our text, the ger alman aviyatom, right? The widow, the orphan, the stranger, et cetera, et cetera. So that's critically important. And look, there are lots of things to be proud of about Israel, tons of things, from the reinvention and the reestablishment of the Hebrew language to all of the incredible Jewish creativity that has come out of the last 125 years, et cetera. That should not be a whitewashing to sort of ignore some of the warts and some of the critiques. So I don't think that those things are necessarily contradictory. And I think that, you know, with everything that we have achieved, which must be celebrated, right? And there are so many, you know, organizations and people committed to celebrating those things. And I hope that we as Reformed Jews continue to celebrate and to support everything that's amazing, amazing about Israel. But in the end of the day, I think we also have to make sure that we don't celebrate those things only and ignore the things that deeply need our attention and our work, which I think is also really the work of Zionism.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
You have given countless talks. You've taught innumerable classes. You've been to Israel. You've lived in Israel. You've had more encounters around and about the topic of Zionism than perhaps anyone I know. Tell us about a firsthand encounter that you've experienced that really surprised you and has really stuck with you and maybe even defined you in relation to your work and your position and your passion for Israel.
It's a wonderful question, and I can do so in a bit of a story. I made Aliyah in 2003, and I began teaching Jewish history for our Reform Movement's high school program. I taught North American Jewish teenagers coming at age 15 or 16 or 17 for a semester in Israel. And one day I got a phone call, you can refer to it sort of as my calling, from a friend of mine. He's actually a conservative rabbi. He was a bit cynical. He's like, it's nice that you're teaching affluent North American Jewish kids to know a little bit about their story, but I want you to work with some real Israelis. And now you have to understand that I was struggling to find what my Zionism was. I knew that Israel actually in Zionism was the answer to my Jewish identity. So he said, listen, what are you doing for Shabbat? I want you to come with me. And I said, okay, I'm there. And he didn't even tell me where I was going. And he said, listen, we got in the car and he started driving. He said, okay, we're going down to a town called Kiryat Gat. And we're going to a boarding school of kids ages 8 to 18, roughly, who are living there because their parents, you know, really couldn't take care of them. So he said to me, you're going to be the Shabbat guy. And I said, oh, okay, what does that mean? He goes, you know, you lead services for them, you have discussions with the kids, you do some activities. Essentially, you're there to be a positive Jewish role model. And I said, okay, I had been a camp counselor long enough. I can figure that out. And I got there and I saw the kids filing into what we call in Hebrew a caravan, or like a makeshift sort of prefab building that was going to be the synagogue for that evening. And I see two kids break out into a fist fight, as it turns out later, over who would have the honor of passing out the Sidurim, you know, the prayer books. And I said, you know, yikes, this is going to be rough. And one of their counselors took me to the side. He goes, oh, you must be the new Shabbat guy. Is that a hint of an American accent that I hear in your Hebrew? And I said, yeah, you know, I just made Aliyah about 2 years ago. And I thought he was going to say, like, oh, that's wonderful. He said, oh, yeah, no, these kids are going to eat you alive. And I said, okay. He says, but don't worry, I'm going to help you. I'm going to teach you a song that only we sing. We're the only school in this entire country that knows this song. And so if you sing with me for a second, well, they'll think that you belong here, that you fit in, you're one of ours, and they'll, you know, they'll go with you. I said, oh, you know, thank goodness. He goes, okay. He goes, listen to me. He starts to sing. And he sings, Shalom Rav, Al Yisrael Amcha. And I turned to Les. And he said, "What, you know that song?" I said, "Oh my goodness, of course. I grew up in URJ summer camps and I was a song leader and I know Danny Freelander and Jeff Klepper." And he said, I don't know what any of that is. Who are those people?" I said, "They're the guys that wrote the song." And now, you know, in Israeli, right, he says, "If some reform cantor and rabbi in America told you they wrote this song," he goes, "No, that song is in the Sidur." I said, "Oh, okay, they didn't write the words. They wrote the melody." And he said, "Okay, whatever, I don't care. Can you sing it?" And I said, yeah. And he pushes me in. And we get through a painful Kabbalat Shabbat. And just after the Amidah, it came time for us to sing the song. And I sort of mustered all of my courage. And before I tell you what happened, you have to understand that I had been really searching. And I sort of wanted to be this, you know, romantic notion of Zionism of yesteryear or even last century, where I wanted to be a kibbutznik and drain the swamps and be, you know, like the pioneers of the second Aliyah. And all my friends laughed at me and told me that, you know, I was, you know, 100 years too late, and that if I wanted to be a Zionist, I should go into high tech, apropos, you know, startup nation. And I said, "Well, that's well and good, but I don't know how to do any of that stuff. I'm a, you know, Jewish educator and rabbi and whatever." And so I'd be really searching. And so I closed my eyes and I started singing with, you know, all the gusto and energy that I could muster. And I start singing these words, Shalom Raham for Yisrael Amcha. And it was sort of magical in that all of a sudden the boys and girls stopped pinching each other and messing with each other, and they sat up straight and started belting out this very loud, slightly Israeli-sounding, off-key version of the same song written by a Reform cantor and rabbi that I had grown up with in my synagogue camp youth movement. And I said, "That's it. That's it for me." Because as I was looking at this group of Israelis from the former Soviet Union, Israelis from Ethiopia, Israelis from Tunis, Morocco, Yemen, Iraq, you name it, sitting boys and girls together in mixed seating, which was not obvious, praying out of an Orthodox Sephardic Sidur, singing a melody written by a Reform rabbi and cantor, I said, that's it. I said, you know, I'm too late to drain the swamps, and I'm not going to work the land, and I'm no good at high tech, but I can help bring Reform Judaism to Israel. Because I had this realization that just because one has a Jewish state doesn't necessarily mean that they have a Jewish community or even a Jewish identity. And the fact of the matter is that I'll call it the polarizing dichotomy between religious or Orthodox and secular no longer answers the needs of the mainstream. And so this was essentially going to be my contribution. And now I've realized that as much as I think Israel needs Reform and liberal Judaism, I think that Reform and liberal Judaism in North America desperately needs Israel as well. And so a vote in this World Zionist Congress gives significant funding to our Israeli Reform movement that can help expand its reach and reach these communities, I think, who are desperately looking for some other form of expression and trying to create something new. So that was the formative moment for me that I realized that this is going to be my path.
Well, my friend, Rabbi Joshua Weinberg, I want to end by thanking you for that work that you do day in, day out in representing us and our values. I want to wish you every success and all of us success in the upcoming World Jewish Congress elections. Thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.